Okay, so the recording for the record has begun. So we were discussing very lofty subjects, but now we have to come down to earth to turn to the parasha. And before we do that, I do want to note our sponsors this evening, Elaine Grossman and Diane Goldstein, who are sponsoring in memory of their beloved father, Eric Hanau. Have I said that right? Eric Hanau, Avram Ben Tzvi, Olav Ashalom, and Sham should have an Aliyah. I wish you both Nechama, Chaim Aruchim. Our learning, our discussion, our company this evening is in their merit and their memory. May his memory be a blessing. Okay, so let's turn to this week's parasha, Parashat Kitissa. Now, last week we didn't get a chance to meet because it was Purim night, and we didn't get a chance to talk about Parashat Tetzaveh. And I won't say that I was relieved. But Truma Tetzaveh V'Yakal Pekudei, there is a huge amount of repetition, and it's incredibly structured. There's not too much ambiguity to kind of stick one's exegetical teeth into. So every year we tend to turn to what are the different symbolic qualities to the Shulchan, what does the menorah represent, how many branches are there. But Kitissa is, for all its tragedy, a welcome shift because we have opportunity to reflect on a huge amount of ambiguity. And if there is one word that I would use to maybe summarize the character or the spirit of this week's parasha, it would be chaos. Chaos would be the way I describe it. And it's probably the least expected description from the way the parasha begins. And that's part of the chaos, is we're kind of lulled into a sense that this is a continuation of Truma Tetzaveh. We had so much order, and we've had so much order since we have been freed from Egypt at the beginning of Shemot, which I've kind of emphasized, probably overemphasized. All the drama we imagine belongs in the book of Exodus is over basically before we've started. We've got Shmot Ve'erobo. We're out already in Bashalach. So everything we're going to be discussing in 3 weeks has already happened. And we're just four parshas in to the book. And then from that moment, from Bashalach and on, we had Yitro, which was the giving of the Torah. There was drama there, but it was organized drama on the part of God. We then had Mishpatim, which is the laying out of civil law in an organized, relatively organized, calm, pedagogical way. We then had Truma Tetzaveh, the structural details about the Mishkan, and everything seems in order. And this week's parasha begins along the same way. When you count the people with Machatzit HaShekel, which we reenacted, many of us, last week by giving half whatever the standard currency is to support public institutions, synagogues, schools, shuls. You count with half a shekel. We then have the details of the wash basin, the kior, at the beginning of the parasha. Again, give us that indication that we're still in the midst of discussing the Mishkan and building the ritual objects. We're then told about the shemen ha-mishcha, the oil that was used for anointing, talking of coasting. Talking about the ketoret, we're told about the incense, the different ingredients of the incense, how no one could make any of this oil or this incense for mundane purposes, not just for illicit purposes, for just mundane purposes. It was illicit, but Salal is chosen to oversee the project, and then we're told about Shabbat, and then everything falls apart. Everything comes apart. We've kind of settled into our seats. We've only read Rishon. Everything I just mentioned is all in Rishon. You've got the Kiyor, you've got the counting, you've got the Ketoret, you've got the Shemen HaMishcha, but Salal is chosen. We're told about Shabbat. In fact, it just struck me as I was thinking through the Parsha that it was actually exactly at this time, about 8:20, 8:25, this time last year, the Thursday night before Parashat Kitissa, that we first as a community got on Zoom. Of course, we weren't entirely sure how the tech worked, and I think it recorded me speaking with my ear on the camera. But that was our first communal virtual gathering as we tried to come to terms with what was happening. That Thursday morning, a year ago, not by the secular calendar, but a year ago on Erev Shabbat Kitisa, a group of us sat in the shul in the morning, gathered close around a table to discuss whether we should be gathering in shul over Shabbat. And it was, this is going to be a bad sports reference, a game time decision. Is that a phrase?
Yep, that's good.
Good. It was a game time decision. There were a few of us on the phone literally 15 minutes before I went on to Zoom to decide whether we were going to close the shul or not. And then the rest is history. And I think that our prudence was well placed. And we have come a long way as a result of the early leadership shown by the shul leadership, the lay leadership, the medical leadership. And we sat and we discussed about that passage from Vishamru Vinei Yisrael et HaShabbat, La'asod et HaShabbat, L'doratam Brit Olam, that God commands us to keep the Sabbath to rest. I gave some attention to the end where it says Shabbat v'yinafash, that we rest because God stopped Shabbat, he stopped v'yinafash, and he was refreshed. And of course, even in crisis, we have to use the Malbim. So I did turn to the Malbim, who suggests that Vayinefash is an odd term to use in the context of God. To speak of God being refreshed almost indicate a need on God's part to breathe and to recuperate. And his notion of Vayinefash, Shavat means to stop, and for him, Vayinefash actually means continued. His essence continued, as in the nefesh of God, Shavat, he stopped the physical labor, but Vayinofash, but his soul continued to function, meaning providence continued. God doesn't go to sleep on Shabbos. He stops any physical, material, cosmic creativity while his essence continued. And of course, we spoke about the fact the shul was going to close, but the essence, the essential work of our community would, of course, continue. And it has. And that kind of closes off all the order that we have in Exodus thus far. And then beginning with Sheni, again, it sounds like things are about to go well. Moshe is told he is given two stone tablets, or if you're Mel Brooks, he's given three stone tablets. I don't know how many of you saw the history of, is it called the History of the World? 2,000-year-old man or something. It's a very funny clip. Well, Mel Brooks dresses up as Charlton Heston and he's carrying three tablets down the mountain. He says, "Here, O Israel, are 15. And he stumbles and he drops one and it breaks. And he goes, 10 commandments. So in the original text, he only had two at the beginning. And they were stone tablets. And I guess before we get to the chaos that unfolds, it is worth asking, why are we told they were made of stone? What else could they be made of, in theory?
Wood.
Yeah.
Paper. They could have been made out of anything because it was a godly thing.
That's true. It could have been titanium, right? Kryptonite, I guess. It could have been. I guess you're right. It could have been anything. And there, in fact, rabbinic traditions that when it says stone, it doesn't mean plain rock. What was it made of? What were the luchot made of? Anyone familiar with the tradition?
Jade.
Oh, good one, Ellie. Jade, that's a kind of stone that a lot of Eastern little statues are made of.
Sapphire.
Right? Sapphire. So, Ellie and Linda have both got interesting different traditions. Linda's the one we've got in Chazal, but Ellie I'll take as well, is that it was made of this kind of blue precious gem. It was made of sapphire. Of course, that's not in the text, but the idea that it was just made of stone seems a difficult, which stresses the question, which is it could have been made of literally anything if it's a godly object, number one. Number two, even if it's not made of kryptonite or titanium, it could reasonably be made. They could have been made out of wood. How do I know it could have been made out of wood? Did they have access to wood?
Yes.
Yeah, how do you know?
Mishkan.
Yeah, they built half the Mishkan's built out of the wood. They could have, God could have had Moshe embroider it. I mean, he was there for 40 days, 40 nights anyway. It could have been embroidered all sorts of ways. Someone else said paper. Yeah, he could have jotted it down. All sorts of ways. So it does, it's such a familiar term for us that they were tablets of stone that sometimes the straightforward questions that a fresh reading lends itself to evade our attention. Why are we told they're made of stone? Who cares? We're not told all details about everything. And certainly here, God gave them to Moshe. Moshe didn't have to go to procure them. So it makes sense when he says, Moses, tell the people to go and build the Mishkan, go and build it out of wood, build it out of gold. They need to know the material details to put it together. He could have said, God gave him Shnei Luchot. But it says, Shnei Luchot Avanim, made of stone. What is the pertinence of the material? Go on, Ellie.
Because with taking a piece of paper and throwing it down, it wouldn't have been much of an impact. But he took the stone and threw it down and it broke into 1,000 pieces. It looked better.
Good one, Ellie. In fact, I'm sure you're thinking of when you were an adolescent, like I was in high school, and a teacher wanted to slam the door in anger. Holden, have you lost me? My computer jumped in. And the teacher wanted to slam the door, and it was a fire door. And they go, what? And then it very slowly closes, and you don't quite have the drama. Yeah, so Ellie says it couldn't have been paper, because then Moshe would have thrown it down, and it would have gone, and no one would have had any drama. Okay, that's one option. That's forward thinking.
There's also a permanence to stone that doesn't exist with wood or anything else.
Excellent. So Stu's suggesting that God wanted it particularly to be out of stone to suggest that this was not a temporary decree. This wasn't just an introductory draft. This was, as we like to say, carved in stone. This was intended to be permanent and not to fade away. And the truth is that there are a lot of commentators and midrashim that give attention to why it particularly is made out of stone. Anyone familiar with any other ideas or want to suggest another idea why stone might be a good material for this? I mean, I can think of a good reason why stone would be a bad material. What's the reason that you might say, why on earth would you use stone for this? Why would paper be a better choice, Ellie, apart from the less drama? Go on, Diane.
Easier to carry.
Yeah, they're about to schlep through the desert. You're giving me two tablets of stone to lug around. Let me jot it down. I'll stick it in my pocket. Norman, you had something?
I was going to say it's a last forever. You know, it's not something that was going to rot or be deteriorate.
Right. So I think is it right? So this is an argument for stone, that there is. It's not just permanent, that it has a kind of a weight to it, but it's not going to disappear. It has an eternality to it. So
an argument against it would be that it could serve as an idol.
Interesting. A monument.
Right.
In fact, we're going to have a number of mitzvot telling us not to set up a matseva, not to set up stone monuments. So we've got a couple of arguments for and a couple of arguments against. One argument for is you need the stone because of symbolic quality. It indicates permanence, it indicates weight. Ellie's idea was that you need to have drama when you drop it. And the arguments against would be this kind of permanence is dangerous in Jewish thought. We try to avoid having permanent items that could be worshipped. Another one is, practically speaking, they're about to go through the desert. Give the guys a break. Don't give them big tablets of stone. And the truth is, if you think about Cecil B. DeMille's version of stone, they're actually quite thin tablets. They look like you could probably manage them. But the dimensions that the sages hand down through tradition is that these were real. Anyone know the dimensions that Chazal suggests the Luchot had? Roughly? What shape were they?
Tablet shape.
Tablet shaped. Yes, thank you. But were they Sudafed or Advil? That's my question. Because those are different. So, I mean, the truth is, Chazal saw them as cuboid, essentially, often in our imagination. I wasn't going to go down this route, but I guess it's come up. There is, in our public imagination, we imagine that the tablets are rounded along the top. And you have those displayed above many Aroni Kodesh. Many famous paintings of the Luchot have them as these kind of round circles. And I think, if I'm not incorrect, that's how it is in the Ten Commandments. Am I right? This will be the Mills version. They're kind of rounded at the top.
Yeah.
I think so.
Yes.
Yeah. So Chazal didn't see them that way. They saw them as entirely square. And in fact, there is a there was a renowned drasha, a speech, a sermon, a sikha that the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, once gave, ascribing this tradition with what they said is not the Chet HaEgel. The Chet HaEgel is the golden calf. The Chet HaEgel is that idea. Eagle meaning round or circular. Agala is like the wheel on a wagon. Chet HaEgel is the sin to assume that the Luchot were rounded along the top. And there is a huge emphasis that they were square. And one could put a lot of attention as to why that's such a significant detail. And it's actually the Christian illuminators of the medieval period who first did this tablet rounded along the top. But if you look at the most ancient drawings, they were all square. And that's the way the Midrash depicts it as well. And Moses is carrying down essentially two blocks of stone, 6 foot by 6 foot by 6 foot. These are huge, whomping things. And Stu's argument was, this could be a monument, which in the West, monuments are important. At some point, I guess we could talk about the controversy around monuments and statues. But Judaism is actually quite a straightforward halachic ideology when it comes to statues, which is take them all down. Because having statues is problematic, and we could talk about that halachically as well, because of course any sort of concretization of material that attracts our worship, adoration, esteem verges on a problematic worship. So that's Stu's point, maybe against it. Also, they're huge. So why are we being told this stuff? So we had a few possible arguments. In fact, there's one midrash that sounds quite heavy, no pun intended, on this subject, which is, it says, Rov ha'anoshim, most of the punishments in the Torah are skila, are stoning. So we're told that they're made of stone to emphasize the kind of weight that comes with this. And I guess, while that sounds quite severe on the surface, the argument being made is that it's not just permanent in the sense that I think Norman was suggesting that there is an eternality to this, that this doesn't erode and it lasts forever. But there is a physical weight, meaning if Moshe had the option between titanium or stainless steel and stone, I'm not a chemist, but my sense is that titanium would outlast rock. Rock does erode eventually, stainless steel, titanium does not. So if you had that contest, the Midrash would suggest you've got to pick the rock anyway. Because it's not so much the endurance, the durability of the substance, it's the weight, the literal weight, the heaviness of it. But people shouldn't think that this is a piece of paper, some guidelines for you to keep, even if it never would disappear. You know, you can't give it to somebody on a flash drive. You call them a flash drive or a thumb disk or something, USB. You can't do that, even though it's going to last forever in virtual space. It has to have physical, concrete weight to it. To communicate that this is a system of law with consequences. So that's one way that it's read as being necessary to made out of stone. Other ones as well, we'll leave for another time. But so that's the beginning of Sheni. And then after we have told about these tablets, that's when the chaos begins. And over the last four parashiyot, what kind of emotions have the main characters exhibited? From the moment that we stood at Har Sinai and we got the Torah, there was some fear there, we're told. They were Yiru, the people were scared, but Yitzhak, the Tachit Har, they stood at the bottom of the mountain. And then Moses took over. Mishpatim, Truma, Tetzaveh. What kind of emotions have we heard expressed?
None.
None. It's been a pretty calm, plain sailing. They're just communicating, just talking, just teaching. But from the moment here, after we're told that Moses was giving the stone tablets, there is an array of confusion, rage, panic, disappointment, resignation. This is where everything falls apart. Moshe is slightly delayed. The Moshe was meant to come down. Did the people know when he was meant to come down, by the way? Did they know it was going to be a 40-day, 40-night trip?
Yes.
It was a question of where you start counting day one.
Okay, so that Eli and Seth are on the same page. That, yes, they knew, and that's a view of Rashi, that they said he's meant to come down on the 25th at 12:55, and it's late. He was meant to be here by now, and that's when they start panicking. There is another view that they didn't know when he was meant to come down. They just thought to themselves, you know, he went up to get something. It's been a pretty long time. I don't know how long I'm meant to wait here. It's like students waiting for a professor. Some places have an official 5-minute policy. If the professor's not here and it's been 5 minutes, everybody run, because then we get the class off. And some places it's like, we don't have a set time, but you know, it's been 10 minutes. I think it's reasonable for us to assume they're not coming. And it's interesting, actually, one of my, one of my older colleagues, last year, mentioned a few years previously on Parashat Ki Tisa, during the laning, he stepped out for a few minutes and went into one of the classrooms in his shul. And then he waited there. And they finished the Haftarah and they put the Torah away. Everyone got in their seats. And then they were waiting for the drasha. And what happened?
No rabbi.
No rabbi. So this is a huge risk as a rabbi, because you're possibly unleashing celebration there. But he said, essentially, the whole place went into panic. What's meant to happen? Where's the rabbi? Who's giving the drasha? Should we give the announcements now? Should we do more stuff? And it broke into this whole fight. And someone said, well, you know something. Why don't you get up and give a Dvar Torah? And someone said, no, let's just daven. And someone said, you got to wait for the rabbi. There was a whole fight. And then he came in and he said, can you imagine what it was like at Har Sinai when they were waiting for Moshe? Which is, I thought, you know what? I'll use that anecdote and then I won't have to do it. Why create chaos when I can just tell you about somebody else's chaos? Which is essentially what happens here, is that there is mass panic among the people. And they turn to Aaron, the brother of the figure they're waiting for, and they say, look, Moshe's not here. We need a replacement. And perhaps the most astonishing thing that I invite your thoughts on is that Moshe's late. He hasn't arrived. The people start to panic. Imagine you're there on the scene. You're waiting for Moshe to come back. He hasn't come back. What is your reaction, your first question? Is he ever coming back? Okay, so you've got doubt, a concern about whether he's coming back. Let's say you want to resolve that question. How do you resolve the question? What's one way to resolve if Moshe's coming back?
Send out a search party.
Yeah, go look for the guy. But what happens? They say, Moshe's late. What are we going to do? Okay, build an idol. You skipped about four steps along the plan A, plan B, plan C. Plan A is, Moshe's not here. Maybe someone should go look for him.
They're not allowed to. They can't go up the mountain.
Okay, so that's interesting. They're not allowed to. So that means that what do they assume? I'm just trying to get in their heads here, because this is a question that seems pretty straightforward. If you don't know, I mean, and we're not told that they thought we should go find him, but we can't. It just, all the text tells us is Moshe was late, Moshesh Moshe was late, and they turned to Aaron and said, Moshe's not here, we need to build something. So Mark is right that maybe one option of what unfolds here, and that this is what I mean by ambiguity that we don't have in Truma and Tetzaveh, is that there is a narrative being described here with purposeful gaps. for us to try to conjure in our minds how they might have reacted. And we've got the fortunate history of exegetes who provide different readings here. So Moshe's late, the people are waiting there. Why do they want to build? Why don't they look for Moshe? And there are different options. One option is, Mark says, they desperately wanted to look for Moshe, but they were bound by God and they were caught in a bind because they were in a state of reverence for God, desperation for Moshe, and they felt like we're in a box. We can't move. That's one option. What's another option? Why might they say we're not going to look for Moshe?
They were sort of happy that he wasn't there. They thought maybe he has all these rules and everything, and let's have a good time.
Yeah, maybe they said this is our chance. You know, Moshe's fine if he's here, but if he's not here, I'm not going to go look for him. it's interesting. There, it was mentioned when I was in homiletics at YU. Which is a fancy word for teaching us how to give sermons. And the way that at least I was taught how to give sermons was listen to Rabbi Haskell Lukstein give sermons. He would come on Friday and he would give a sermon and say, what do you think? And then tell us how we put it together. And one of the comments Rabbi Lukstein made when he was telling us about, you know, how to try to be engaging and communicate and how to break down the craft of writing a sermon, one of the things he said was, speaking about his time learning with Rabbi Soloveitchik, the Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, he said he used to give one of the shiurim every year at the RCA conference at one point. The Rabbinic Council of America had a rabbinic conference once a year, and they would have a special lecture delivered by Rabbi Soloveitchik. And he said every year the atmosphere in that room was intense. You could feel the power of the attention in the room as they sat there waiting for Rabbi Soloveitchik to come. People sitting with their notepads. Of course, they didn't have quite the phone recorders and everything else like that, but they were sitting there ready to absorb an hour and a half of serious thought, probing Torah, uplifting ideas, and they were ready. And one year, Rabbi Lukstein said he was sitting there and they were all sitting in their chairs ready for this major presentation. And then someone came in and said, I'm terribly sorry to tell you this, but Rabbi Soloveitchik's not feeling well and he can't be here today. And Rabbi Lukstein said the relief in the room was, whoo, now we can relax. And so to kind of rein back a little bit, Ellie's depiction is it's quite possible to have deep respect for someone, but also recognize that their presence is heavy it's an effort to absorb their greatness. To some degree, I had a measure of this when I was in Gush and Rav Aaron Lichtenstein gave a shiur twice a week, and they were long shiurim, and they were heavy, they were weighty, they were deeply analytical. It was in many ways intellectually exhausting. And on top of the intellectual exhaustion, there was the constant anxiety that he was going to point at you and tell you to read or ask you a question. And he wouldn't do it in English, of course. It was a Hebrew shiur. And his speech, certainly in the years that I was there, was not clear. So number one, it's not in my first language. Number two, I'm not sure if I'm going to understand what he's saying, even if I knew Hebrew. In fact, one of my friends, when he first came to the yeshiva, Rav Lichtenstein went up to him and asked him some questions. And he said, Slicha ni lo medaber ivrit. And Rav Lichtenstein said, and he walked away. And then someone came up to him and said he was speaking in English, which made for an awkward first meeting. But there is sometimes when you have greatness, great minds, it's a huge weight. And Ellie's suggestion is when they hear Moshe's not coming, it's actually, they don't want to look for him. There's a part of them that says he's meant to be. And of course, if he's here, we'd be at his feet. He's the greatest. He was our liberator. There's nothing more we could want. But frankly, we feel a little bit of relief without Moshe's presence here. So maybe that's one way to read it. So we've got two views so far. One is Mark's view that they felt compelled not to climb the mountain and been told not to. One is Eli's view, which is maybe there was a measure of relief that he wasn't there. Any other options? Why wouldn't they look for him? What might they think Moshe's doing? I mean, so far we've got two very reverential views of Moshe. One view is we revere him deeply and we revere God. We can't go and send a search party on the sacred terrain. The other one is if we revere him greatly, but we're only human and we feel a little bit of relief now, so we don't really want to follow up on this this crisis. Is there another way to think about their relationship with Moshe?
Well, I have trouble understand seeing the people as kind of the kids in the classroom with the teacher out of the room, because I've been listening to Rabbi Sacks in the last couple of parshiyot. He talks about the nation as being very immature and reliant on Moshe, and you know, being given everything through the midbar, having to rely on him for everything. So for me, it's more like Moshe's abandoning us, like more of a fear rather than, oh, it's great, you know, we're free, Moshe's not here. It's more like he speaks about the Mishkan being their opportunity to gain dignity and being able to give, because they've been always taking everything. And that wasn't, you know, that they're just very immature as a nation. So I have trouble with that picture of them like wanting to just be free because the teacher's out of the room. I feel like they were worried and they were feeling abandoned.
Fascinating. So that's a third avenue for us to explore, which is that they don't want to send looking after Moshe because they don't think Moshe's lost. Moshe doesn't get lost. Moshe found his way back from Midian. Moshe's the one who left them through the Red Sea. Moshe doesn't get lost. If Moshe hasn't come back, the people think he doesn't want to be found. Why should I send a soldier? He doesn't want to be here. There is, from this moment, deep suspicion about Moshe. It doesn't start in Bamidbar when Moshe starts complaining. It starts right now. The people don't quite... When do we have the first example that the people don't trust Moshe? The first example of an encounter with Moshe where the people seem a little dubious about his motives, about
in
his
Egypt.
Connection.
In Egypt.
Okay, where in Egypt, Diane?
Where, you know, some people saw him kill the Mitzri.
Oh, excellent. I thought you were somewhere else and I would have said, what about even earlier? But yeah, you're right. His very first contact with Jews is filled with suspicion. They turn around. He says, don't hit each other. And he says, don't hit each other? Who on earth are you? You're a prince of Egypt. We saw you kill the, you can do, you're going to kill us like you killed the Egyptian. So there's already an assumption of disconnect. And of course, all around that narrative, we don't know if they know he's Jewish, if he knows he's Jewish. There's a lot of ambiguity around that too, but certainly there's distrust. And we're told that narrative to implant in our minds as the readers and the students of this text, that there is dubiousness. And what about later, back in Egypt, after Moshe's been away and he comes back? Is there another moment where there is suspicion?
Well, when he says he's going to ease their burden, and Paro makes the burden harder, so they're not exactly fans of his.
Right, exactly. So the first two contacts Moshe has with Jews are rife with suspicion. The first when he is the prince of Egypt, and the second when he comes back as the son of the priest of Midian. And they're the ones in the pits with raw hands and whipped backs. And Moshe comes along having eaten well for the last 40 years and raised a family in peace, who claims we're going to get out of here if only we hold on a little longer. Well, Moshe, we've been hanging on here for 200 years. You haven't worked a day in your life. Not once were you here as a slave. So from the start, there is suspicion. Of course, it's hard for them not to imagine Moshe's commitment. In fact, when they cross the Red Sea, what are we told? That they believed in V'yaminu b'Hashem,
Moshe Avdo.
And what an astonishing thing to say. The sea split, and you think, whoa, if I see that, I'm going to believe in God too. They believed in his servant. Was there any doubt? And of course, the text is insinuating, yes, until that moment, and maybe after that moment, they had doubts about Moshe's commitment to their survival. You've got the suspicion. And of course, right before the sea is split, what do they say to Moshe? in polite terms. They turn around and they say, Moses.
Goes back.
Yeah, why did you brought us out here to die in the desert? As soon as there is an opening, the people suspect that Moshe's up to something. Or even if they don't suspect he's up to something, they suspect he doesn't understand their position. You can't appreciate how terrible our state is. You're just an outsider. You're lahavdil, like when American troops go in to liberate a country and then the American troops expect that all the locals are going to turn around and say, thank you so much, you're so lovely. And they don't trust him. And they say, get out. Who do you think you are, you foreign invader? You're like, we came here to help you. And of course, there is deep suspicion from those who have been traumatized and oppressed to outside liberators. And Moshe is seen through that lens. And it's quite possible that at this moment, Moshe's late. And they think, we knew it. We believed him at the sea. B'yaminu b'ashem of Moshe, after we believed him then, we thought he's attached to us. He understands our predicament. He has gone as far as making sure the sea splits to get us through. We're in the same boat. And now he was just waiting to bring us to this mountain so that he could go up to the top and say, okay, everybody, I'm just going up the mountain. I'll be back soon. 40 days later, they imagine he's back in Midian having a feast, saying, those silly guys, those dupes are sitting at the mountain waiting for me, and I've gone on with my life. I did my mission. They're out of Egypt, and they feel abandoned. So that's our suggestion. That they don't send a search party because they don't think he's lost. They think he doesn't want to be found. And that deep abandonment leads them to craft a replacement. And it's a very odd replacement. They're not stupid to build a golden calf after Egypt has just been decimated. It seems an astonishing choice. And it seems to be rash, desperate, falling back into old patterns, a default. It's certainly a regression in terms of their religious imagination. And maybe it is a sense of fear, anxiety, and abandonment that leads them to do this. So we've got, again, a very ambiguous moment. Of course, at that time, God reports to Moshe, you know what's happening down there? They're building a golden calf. And Moshe says, well, let me check it out. You know, don't do anything yet. Because if you kill them now, what's everybody going to say? That you brought them out to the desert to kill them. It's not a good look, God. Let me do the PR for you. I'm going to go and sort it out. He goes down the mountain. He bumps into Joshua on the way down. Yahshua says, I hear the sound of war. Moshe says, it's the sound of revelry. And I'm sure many of us have the scene from the Ten Commandments when they meet halfway down the mountain. And Joshua says, I hear the sound of war in the camp. And Moses says, that's not a war. That's the sound of song and celebration. And then you can hear the revulsion, the disgust in his voice as he turns around and he sees them. And then we're told, the Yichar Af Moshe. Moshe was angry. When before this moment were we told that Moshe was angry? Has there been a point yet where we're told that Moshe's angry? Say that again, Ora? No. Right. No. Right. This was partially a test because I part of me has a sneaking suspicion it does say somewhere he did, but I think you're right.
I think it's with Paro.
Yes. Thank you. You're right. That's a little sneaking suspicion there. Right after, before the seventh plague with the locusts begin, the Yichar of Moshe, it says that Moshe got angry with Pharaoh and walked out. And the reason it was just a sneaking suspicion is because it's very strange that he gets angry with Pharaoh at that moment. And a number of the commentaries, I think the Kabbalah says, it doesn't mean he got angry. It means he turned his nose, meaning he left the room backwards. He was still kind of showing him reverence. It's a very odd reading. But you're right. So there is an indication that he got angry with Pharaoh. But here it's unambiguous that he's angry. Yichar af Moshe, he is angry. And not only does Moshe get angry, who else gets angry? And I'll say who with a capital W, if that's
God.
God is described as angry. Was God angry about the Jews in being in Egypt? Is he described as angry with Pharaoh?
No.
No. So this is partially what I meant, that chaos is unleashed here, is that even in the depths of despair in Egypt, the cosmos is in a state of calm as it tries to sort itself out, as providence heads toward a resolution. God shows his might with a Yad Chazakah, Vizroen Etu Yah. There are wonders and miracles and plagues and drama, but there is a sense of providential calm that destiny is unfolding. And here there is a rupture where God is angry and Moses is angry. It's 9 o'clock. I guess we're not going to go too far. But what does Jewish thought think about anger? Is anger a good or bad thing generally?
Bad.
Okay, so we're all on the same page. Anger is bad. It's interesting. Rambam Maimonides, some of you may be familiar with this, is heavily.
It depends. Sometimes anger is useful.
Okay, Debbie says anger is useful.
According to Rambam, to teach.
Say again. I missed that. I missed the last part of what you said, Debbie. But you said anger can be useful, and I confess I have found it useful at times, which is interesting. Do we ever have an obligation to be angry? Is it ever a moral obligation to be angry?
If someone feels that they're wrong, they have an obligation to say something,
seek justice. Say again, Norman.
I was going to say, when there's this disjustice, you know, when people are being murdered or people are being hurt, or so there's reasons to be angry.
So I think this is very interesting. There is a stream in Jewish thought that suggests exactly as Norman and Diane and Debbie suggests, that there are times, well, we'll come to Debbie in a minute maybe, but Norman and Diane says there are times when we have an obligation to be angry. And in fact, it is immoral not to be angry. And in fact, that is exactly the formulation of Thomas Aquinas, a medieval theologian, who says that to be surrounded by injustice and not be angry is immoral. Suggests that there are good times not to be angry, when we have an obligation to pursue justice. And in fact, in the Hasidic context, this is a major trope. The emotion unleashed is an important signal of our moral condition. And to not feel anger over an injustice is a signal of a shallow humanity on our part. It's interesting because Maimonides actually disagrees with that. I've only got a couple minutes before Mara starts. Oh, no, I'm teaching Dante's Inferno and NYC this semester. And today we happen to get into the fifth circle of hell, which is just my teaching style anyway. But we happen to be in the fifth circle of hell, which is the circle of wrath, where people are angry. And one of the astonishing things about Dante is, as he depicts himself in this circle full of people who are punished for eternity due to their wrath, he gets angry. And as he's angry, he is praised for that anger. And the scholars who've read this suggest that he is suggesting that there is illicit wrath and there is righteous anger. And he's following actually a major influence in near contemporary Thomas Aquinas, who says there are times where there's a moral obligation to be angry. Maimonides, who precedes Dante by about 100 years, actually takes a view that in Jewish thought, there is never, ever, ever a time where it is morally warranted to be angry. He says, Abe's citation, Lo tamod al dam re'echa, don't stand by while someone else is being harmed. All the cases that Norman and Diane described of rife injustice, when other people are being tortured and tormented, Rambam says, well, what use is anger? Just seek justice. Keep calm. And in fact, getting angry can only lead to more damage. You're not going to think clearly. You're not going to take the right strategy. Of course, one could argue this one way or other, but Rambam takes a view that is infrequent in that he disputes Aristotle. Because Aristotle, again, takes this medium ground where there's excesses of anger and there's excesses of feeling nothing, of apathy. And there's a middle ground of righteous anger, which is what Dante takes. And the Rambam says, no, there are two traits in human life where we have to be extreme all the time and the middle road doesn't work. One of them is anger. Anyone know what the other one is? I tell you. But I'm too humble. He says, humble, humility is the other one. He says, you can never, ever have enough humility. There's no middle ground. Aristotle says you can be too humble, in which case you're not living a happy, productive life if you're meek all the time. It's called meekness. For Maimonides, you can never be too humble, and you can never be too, you can always be too angry. So this is where we come to Debbie, and I guess we'll finish here, is that Rambam, in his Hilchot Deot, where he's describing one's attitude to anger, he says, of course, in Debbie's words, anger can be useful. And if I'm, you know, if I'm here and my two kids are, you know, it's time to go to bed and they've decided they're both from Monsters, Inc. and they're just running in circles for an hour screaming and I want them please to stop so we can put them to bed. I think at that point, you know what might be useful now is if I raise my voice a little bit. And I, you know, I'll give a warning. I'm going to count to three.
Even shaming.
I didn't hear that clearly. Say again.
Even shaming anger.
Right. And that's what Rambam says. He says, look, if anger can be useful, you can employ it as a pedagogical strategy. You can feign anger, raise your voice, crunch up your contours of your countenance, but inside be as calm as a river. That's what rivers aren't calm. What's the calm thing? Lakes. Be as calm, just be calm, as the body of water that's calm, as a bath before my kids get into it. So, yes, and he says there are times when anger can be useful, but it should never be real. And the truth is, Rambam has a number of defenses on his side. If we look to Chazal, the Talmud, there are numerous times where it says ka'as is like idol worship. Being angry is like idol worship. There's anger. If you're wise, you lose your wisdom. If you're a prophet, you lose your prophecy. And it's the Gemara says, how do I know this? In Moshe, from Moses, because Moses gets angry. They actually don't use this example, but in Matot, which at the end of Bamidbar, when Moshe gets angry because the people didn't follow through on all his instructions, the yiktsof, it says he got angry in a different verb. And then Elazar has to step in and resolve an issue. And Chazal say, why did Elazar have to step in? Because Moshe was in a state, he lost his faculties. He was so angry, he couldn't think straight. And that's an indication that we should never, ever, ever be angry. Now, I think, and although when Rambam says, you shouldn't be angry, he says, don't be angry, afilu badava hara'ui lechos alav, even about something where it's fitting to be angry over it. So he does slip in a defense or a justification of those who get angry. He says, look, there are things in the world that is worth being angry over. I'm just saying, characteristically, it's not helpful and it's bad for the character. But I'm not saying you shouldn't be angry about it. You know, we should all be angry about it, but we should practice. And he says, v'yilmod atzmav, teach yourself not to be angry because it's never going to help. But then, of course, we've got the question, so why is God angry here? Why is Moshe angry here? And this kind of, I'll leave it here, is that we're in a very difficult pivot in the story of the Exodus, which is yet to be resolved, which is everything was flowing smoothly. We came out of Egypt. Amalek came at us, and guess what? We won. Nothing can harm us. Yitro comes. The world is at our feet. We get the Torah. We get civil law. We've now got a house to focus our ritual worship, to manifest the presence of God, and everything seems calm. We've got the wash basin, all good. We've got the incense cooking. We've got the oil being brewed, but Shalel is under commission to build the Mishkan, and we've got Shabbat. And then everything falls apart. Chaos begins, and the challenge going into next week, into Vayakel Pekudei, is can we get back on track? And in many ways, this moment gives the next 2 weeks far more importance rather than just repeating Truma Tetzaveh. The stakes are, can we bring ourselves back to where we were? So we'll pick up there next week. I want to, again, just acknowledge Elaine Grossman, Diane Goldstein, sponsoring in memory of their beloved father, Eric Hanau. I want to thank you, Nisham should have an Aliyah. I'm not running anywhere. Marv will start in a few minutes on this channel, but I do want to wish you all a wonderful Shabbos, a restful Shabbos, and a peaceful Shabbos. So good Shabbos. Good to see you all.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Good Shabbos.
Take care. Thank you.
Good Shabbos, one and all.
Shabbos. Thank you.
Thank you. Good Shabbos.
Good Shabbos.
Shabbat Shalom.